The Guardian.
The festive season is fast approaching, so this year, while you're busy buying gifts for friends and family, why not treat yourself too? This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the simple yet powerful all-in-one website building platform. With Squarespace, you can easily create your own website for your small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog. It's simple, and it'll be the one gift you know you won't want to return. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Richard Lee.
We're examining the gaps in the world this week on a podcast beamed out to you over the highways and byways of the internet, which asks how words bridge over the vastness of the ocean, how they leap across the chasm of death. The historian Malcolm Gaskell explores how the Atlantic voyage transformed the English men and women who were heading for the New World in the 17th century, and how their struggle to remain connected, to reach across the seas, wound up driving a wedge between them and the people they left behind, all the same. But first, we welcome Michelle Faber, whose latest novel, The Book of Strange New Things, sends missionary Peter Lee away from a happy life with his wife and their cat to minister to the alien inhabitants of the planet Oasis.
The creature, the person, stood upright, but not tall. 5'3", maybe 5'4". Funny how those imperial measurements, inches, miles, stubbornly refused to be left behind. Anyway, he, or she, was delicate, small-boned, narrow-shouldered, an unassuming presence, not at all the awesome figure Peter had prepared himself to confront. As foretold, a hood and monkish robes, made of a pastel-blue fabric, disconcertingly like bath towel, covered almost all of the body, its hems brushing the toes of soft leather boots. There was no swell of bosom, so Peter, aware that this was flimsy evidence on which to base a judgment, but unwilling to clutter his brain with unwieldy repetitions of he or she, decided to think of the creature as male. "Hi," said Granger, extending her hand. The Oasen extended his hand in return, but did not grasp Granger's. Rather, he touched her gently on the wrist with his fingertips. He was gloved. The gloves had 5 digits. "You. Here. Now," he said. "A-her-ri." His voice was soft, reedy, asthmatic sounding. Where the S's should have been, there was a noise like a ripe fruit being thumbed into 2 halves. "Not a bad surprise, I hope," said Granger. "I hope together with you." The Oasen turned to look at Peter, tilted his head slightly so that the shadows from the hood slid back. Peter, having been lulled by the Oasen's familiar shape and 5-fingered hands into expecting a more or less human face, flinched. Here was a face that was nothing like a face. Instead, it was a massive whitish-pink walnut kernel. Or no, even more, it resembled a placenta with 2 fetuses, maybe 3-month-old twins, hairless and blind, nestled head to head, knee to knee. Their swollen heads constituted the Oasen's clefted forehead, so to speak. Their puny ribbed backs formed his cheeks. Their spindly arms and webbed feet merged in a tangle of translucent flesh that might contain, in some form unrecognizable to him, a mouth, nose, eyes. Of course, there were no fetuses there, not really. The face was what it was, the face of an Oasen, nothing else. But try as he might, Peter couldn't decode it on its own terms. He could only compare it to something he knew. He had to see it as a grotesque pair of fetuses perched on someone's shoulders, half shrouded in a cowl. Because if he didn't allow it to resemble that, he would probably always have to stare at it, dumbfounded, reliving the initial shock, dizzy with the vertigo of unsupported falling, in that gut-wrenching instant before a solid comparison is found to clasp onto. "You and I," said the oasen. "Never before now." The vertical cleft in the middle of his face squirmed slightly as he formed the words. The fetuses rubbed knees, so to speak. Peter smiled but could not summon a response. "He means he hasn't met you before," said Granger. "In other words, he's saying hello."
Michelle, I particularly love that passage because of what it reveals about the nature of your writing. There's a gentleness in your writing, and then you suddenly bust it apart with an image that is absolutely horrifying, taken on a literal level.
Yes.
And then you bring it back to Peter saying, "Well, actually, I was just trying to render it recognisable to me, this alien."
Yes.
This is sort of part of how you construct your fiction, isn't it?
It is. I've always been compelled to take the reader to very dark and scary places, but have also felt an obligation to offer the reader consolation on the way, or a gentleness of spirit, because I think that if you take the reader to confront horrifying things, if you don't give them something more generous-spirited or more morally pure or something to make that journey worthwhile, then there is a risk that you're just showing off how bad you can make the reader feel. You know, I have the literary powers to take you into the heart of darkness, into the epicenter of horror, and now I'm just going to dump you there, and that's showing off that I have the power to do that to you. And I feel that that's a misuse of skill.
Again and again, you use metaphors that are totally unexpected, that the metaphor of the fetuses, or the metaphor of their language being like a trombone made out of a watermelon strung together with elastic bands.
Yes.
I mean, where on earth did that come from?
Where I get them, they're free. They just, you pick them up.
But it's a sort of profound set of contradictions. I mean, if you think about it, a trombone couldn't possibly be made out of a watermelon, and yet it works because of the confidence with which you use it.
Yes, you're made to imagine the unimaginable, which I guess is one of the challenges that I set myself in this book, to make the unimaginable imaginable.
In a way, it is science fiction. We've got Peter, who we met there, who is a Christian missionary who's been sort of beamed in an almost Doctor Who way to a galaxy, or is it indeed another galaxy, another space-time continuum, millions, millions and billions of miles away. But in a way, it's very domestic as well.
Yes. Well, the setup of it is that Peter is very happily and intimately married to Bea, his wife, and they are both grilled by this shadowy organization called USIC as to their suitability for going on this mission. And she, as we find out later, fails whatever entrance requirements are set for her. So she has to stay back home, in this case, you know, on our planet. And he passes his entrance exam, so to speak, and gets to go to Oasis. And the novel is largely about the distance that looms up between them as partners. So in that sense, it's a domestic novel. It's a novel about the love of two people being put under an unendurable test. And then, of course, there are the sci-fi elements of the book.
But Bea actually is in a different novel, in a sense, isn't she? I mean, their domestic life, which is torn apart, from which they both go into different novels. She's in a dystopian horror novel, in a way, a different
sort of
novel, because the Earth is undergoing various catastrophes, which we won't give away, at the time at which he's safely insulated with the Oasens.
Well, that's one of the things that I play with in reader expectations of what they will encounter in this book, because when he sets off, you sort of expect that he's going to have all the big and scary challenges in his mission and that she will be safe at home in a rather boring, mundane context. And in fact, it turns out quite the opposite, because the creatures that Peter is ministering to, contrary to his expectations, already love the Word of God. They have already embraced Christianity and indeed have, for his benefit, named themselves Jesus Lover 1, Jesus Lover 2, Jesus Lover 17, and so on. So he's got quite a cushy job up there and a very serene existence. He enters quite a Zen state when he's ministering to these people, and it's his wife back home who is dealing with all the disasters and the dramas. And part of the tension in the book is his increasing alienation from her, his sense that he really isn't interested and can't relate to all the data that she is firing to him.
To what extent is this a religious book?
Well, I'm an atheist, but I find the whole phenomenon of smug atheism very peculiar. You know, this idea that atheism is the blessed state that you evolve into once you're smart enough to see through the childishness of religion. You then become a full grown-up. I actually think that the prospect of a universe without God is terrifying. So in this novel, I'm trying to look at the consolations that religion can offer and the things that people turn to or cling to when there is nothing left to cling to, when the pain that they're suffering is literally unendurable and they need something, anything, to help them endure.
The context in which you write this is the death of your wife, Eva, and her incredible belief in it over many years. Will you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. I actually conceived the novel before she was diagnosed. So in a awful sort of way, it was anticipatory of what both of us were going to have to deal with. And one of the cruel ironies of the book is that, you know, one of the things that the book tries to achieve in the reader is for us all to be more grateful than we are for the miraculous machine that we inhabit, our bodies, because our bodies are miracles, the way they repair themselves, the way they heal themselves, no matter what you do to them. And she, sadly, had one of the few diseases that cannot be cured, one of the few fates where the body cannot heal itself. So that hung heavy over the book. I started writing it quite a long time before she was diagnosed, and I decided that, unlike books like The Crimson Petal and The White, where I knew everything in advance, where everything was planned out meticulously and it was just a matter of carrying it off well, that with this book I would take a journey into the dark, that I would not know what was going to happen to Peter, that I wouldn't know who he would meet, what they would say to each other or do with each other when they met. I wouldn't know how the relationships would pan out. I wouldn't know whether Peter, for example, was going to have sex with Granger or not, etc. None of these things were known beforehand. And I decided that that would be a good way for me to be less in control, because I felt that I'd reached the stage as a writer where I was so skilled that I could make you believe virtually anything, even if it wasn't true to life. And I started writing the book in that way. And of course, what that required of me was that each chapter should be written in complete technicolor, in total publishable form, so that I had lived it, you know, I had experienced it along with Peter in order to know what would happen to him next. I couldn't just sketch it out, because then I wouldn't truly have experienced it or gone on that journey with him. So once Eva was diagnosed, that method of writing became extremely difficult.
Because it meant you had to physically separate yourself from her in order to write.
Exactly. I mean, writing is a solitary pursuit. And for me to take myself into my study and retreat or journey into a completely blank place where I would conjure a narrative universe out of nothing, when I knew that in the next room, you know, my wife had cancer, that our time together was going to be circumscribed. It became increasingly difficult to write the book, and for a long time it seemed as if the book would never get finished. And it was Eva who was responsible for me finishing it. She made me promise to write 6 lines a day, which I did. And she not only got to see it finished, she not only worked on it with me, but she knew that it would be published. And she knew that there was a buzz around the book, but she sadly didn't live long enough for it to be published.
You said in October that this was your last novel, that you'd written everything you had to write on Earth. Yeah. Can that be the case? We were terribly upset on The Guardian. We blogged about it.
Hmm. First of all, there's a lot of books by other people to read out there, and the absence of more novels by me isn't going to impoverish the people out there significantly. Secondly, a lot of people don't read short stories. They read novels rather than short stories. And if people are as keen on my work as they claim to be, then maybe they'll investigate the short stories if there are no more novels forthcoming. That's not to say that's my game plan or anything, but you know, if you really are hungry for more, it's out there. And also, I never wanted to be the sort of writer who puts out books because that's my job.
I'm interested in something that we've touched on quite a lot in this, which is about gentleness.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, although you've written a sort of quite a ribald novel in Crimson Petal, and you've written science fiction with quite shocking images in it, there is always in your work a sort of underlying gentleness.
There is. There's a scene in the Crimson Petal where Sugar has just landed the job of being the governess of Sophie, the very neglected little girl. And Sophie wets the bed, and in the middle of the night, Sugar is there. And she, Sophie, the little girl, is terrified of the consequences of this act. And Sugar just says, "Trust me." And that is so crucial in my work, that phrase, "trust me." I really want readers to be able to trust me as an author. And part of that trust should be based on an underlying compassion. Even if there are horrific things being tackled, there is still, I hope, a gentle spirit underlying it. And in this book in particular, The Book of Strange New Things, I think this in some ways is the saddest book I've ever written, because it's dealing with loss of so many kinds, but I think it's also the most compassionate, the most gentle-spirited of all my books, and in that sense I think it's quite an appropriate sort of note to end on.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
The distances Faber creates in fiction are mirrored in the real-life separations of those who sailed across the Atlantic to look for a better life in the 17th century. For the historian Malcolm Gaskell, settlers who crossed the oceans to find a way of turning back the clock found something entirely new, an identity forged from the terrors of the journey and the hardships of life on the other side. He began by summoning a New England hurricane, a storm which left Anthony Thatcher mourning his cousin Joseph Avery and all his 5 children.
Before dawn on August the 15th, 1635, a hurricane hit the New England coast. Trees were uprooted, houses flattened and ships wrenched from anchor. The James of Bristol, which was carrying Yorkshire migrants, was blown from the Isle of Shoals and almost wrecked at Piscataqua. The Reverend Joseph Avery was sailing from New Ipswich, north of Salem, to lead the church at Marblehead. With him was his cousin Anthony Thatcher, who was a tailor from Wiltshire, and their families, along with four mariners. As the women clutched distraught children, their pinnace was lifted and smashed on the shore of an island, scattering its passengers. Some climbed the rocks only to be washed off. Thatcher and his wife made it to safety. Of the Averys, there was no sign, nor of Thatcher's five children. Shivering beneath a fallen tree, Thatcher was tormented by them, as he said later, looking ruefully on me on the rock, their very countenances calling unto me to help them. Anthony and Elizabeth Thatcher, the only survivors, were rescued 3 days later, and with shaking hand and drowned pen, Anthony sent news to relatives in England. He never recovered, blaming himself for his children's deaths when they could have lived safely in England. He was tormented by dreams of what he called his poor silent lambs. The tragic island, named Thatcher's Woe, became a physical reminder of the episode and joined the growing law of sacrifice at the core of New England's identity. Horror and hardship made English people in New England feel special. It made them feel like New Englanders. After the decision to emigrate, this process began with the willing suspension of normal life. Property had to be sold or entrusted, debts settled, money borrowed. One man secured a passage by persuading his brother-in-law to invest in Massachusetts Bay. The Reverend John Fisk's wife was disinherited when she announced her departure, so the Fisks had to wait for John's father to die to get to Salem. Funds permitting, all manner of clothes, tools, utensils and foodstuffs had to be bought and loaded. Promoters issued lists, and letters home indicated things forgotten or brought in insufficient quantities. John Winthrop asked his eldest son, John, to bring spades, shovels, axes, sieves and shoes, and a carpenter and a cooper. Men took silver, which went straight back to England to buy necessities. Ships left England packed with everything from butter, cheese and raisins to hats, canvas, nails and buttons. Cautious migrants travelled light, then had their possessions sent over once they were settled. Arrival, like departure, was a fraught business. In Boston, a committee apportioned land to newcomers, usually at Muddy River. Robert Hull, a Leicestershire blacksmith, was given a great allotment of land there in 1636 and built a house, as instructed. Hull found it hard to get settled, but as his son John, then aged 11, later explained, God had moved them rather to endure a voluntary exile from their native soil and to hazard the loss of all their sweet outward comforts and relations than to defile their consciences. Massachusetts would be grateful. John Hull became the colony's richest man and its saviour. Over 100 people left Wiltshire between 1635 and 1638, mostly young, single servants and artisans. But a significant number of couples left for the New World too, and there were strong ties of kinship overall. Emigrating with relatives and neighbours had the appeal of safety in numbers, but could still be nerve-wracking. In the 1630s, some 50 families felt compelled to leave Norwich, 7 left from Diss, and more left from towns across Norfolk, 1,350 people in all. Some godly ministers were accompanied by their flocks, as happened at Hingham, a village blighted by poverty, plague and persecution. Beginning a 5-year exodus, the Reverend Peter Hubbard led his parishioners to a place south of the Charles River, which naturally they called Hingham. Even there they conflicted with non-Puritans from the West Country who knew Hingham as Bear Cove and whom gradually they replaced. Lone migrants were less fortunate in this regard, but could remake themselves. Rogues could morph silently into blameless colonists. The opportunity to leave the past behind certainly made it easier for people to engage in adultery and bigamy. Christopher Gardner set up home with a woman said to be a known harlot, despite him having wives in London and Paris. He also convinced people that he was a knight. Leaving behind a reputation, however, might be a mixed blessing. A Virginia woman, who in 1634 slandered a neighbour, saying that she'd seen her whipped as a whore in England, was herself censured because there was no one to substantiate the claim. One woman struggled to prove that she had been married in England. A man struggled to prove he had not. A man who had traitorously clipped silver from coins swore he'd been pardoned in London, but there was no one to corroborate his story, and he was repatriated to England. Others who looked forward to starting over soon discovered flaws in themselves that prevented them from fitting in anywhere. In the mid-1630s, Barbara Rolfe was hounded out of Massachusetts, where no one would take her into service. Her father had sent her to America after she rejected, it was noted, a civil and orderly course of life, contrary to his fatherly admonitions and persuasions. Colonists became accustomed to danger, electrical storms, extreme temperatures, predators and vermin, and acquired local knowledge. They learned how to kill wolves with fish hooks wrapped in fat, and how to render bear grease to make an ointment. The testicles of a muskrat gave linen, it was said, a grateful smell. Cattle were kept away from snake root to keep their milk from causing an illness known as the trembles. When bread and maize were expensive, people ate fish, which was cheap, and shellfish, which was free. Children seemed to do well on the new diet.
The first thing that struck me about the book was the extraordinary scale of this migration. I mean, you say 350,000 people over the course of the 17th century, which is, in a country of 4 million people, it's almost 10%.
Yeah. Well, of course, this is spread over the whole period, so it doesn't come in one great lump. But it is felt locally, because, of course, a lot of the early migrants are coming from East Anglia. And there is a definite feeling in certain towns that key people are disappearing.
It's not only that, but also it's both ways. People are going forwards and backwards and forwards and backwards again. It's the most kind of extraordinary movement of people.
Well, in some American historiography, there's the idea that Europe's had it, England's had it, and you go to America and you stay there. But of course, this is very much a two-way street, the Atlantic, and that many of the people who go there never intend to stay. And that even if they decide in the end they will, they've still got family and friends and business interests in England. So they're constantly coming to and fro. So although in the early days, from the 1620s and 1630s, it's rather a fraught enterprise travelling across the Atlantic, and it's long and boring, it can be dangerous, it does become rather normal. So that this is more of a transatlantic society than sometimes we're led to believe.
But it is difficult to kind of understand in our world of instant communication. It's difficult to appreciate the kind of brute distance of the thing, the remoteness of the other side of the Atlantic, even as you say, after it became a kind of normal journey. How did this experience of a 2 or 3 month crossing change those who survived, who made it?
Well, it's a very special thing for particularly those who migrated in the early years. One of the hardest things they have to do is decide to go in the first place. And once you decide to go, it's in itself a kind of rite of passage, but actually getting on that ship, although it can be extremely tedious and frightening, it's something from which later on people derive a sense of joy and specialness in themselves, that they were the ones who were packed together. It's almost, a sort of a frontline experience. They're a kind of a brotherhood, and that no one else who can really identify with them who hasn't been through the same thing.
I mean, the early settlements had little success and wound up often in disaster. I mean, colonists eating horses, cats, dogs, and even starting to dig up dead corpses out of graves and eat them. I mean, why was it so very, very hard for settlers to create functioning societies on the brave new world?
Well, it's very commonly the case that when they arrive, there is actually nothing there at all. And they dig holes in the ground and they put tarpaulins over them. They live in caves, and often they've been living in houses in England that are not bad, and they, of course, sit there in the rain thinking, well, you swapped that for this. And that's one of the reasons why often people go home. But you have to really do everything from scratch. So the first thing they do is they learn everything in England that they've taken for granted. So they are lacking in the essentials of shelter. You have to then organise food. You have to get people working to plant food. So you do have to build the society you're familiar with from scratch. But then beyond that, you have to create a division of labour. You need a social hierarchy and you need law. And so that everything is being reinvented or adapted or recreated in a way that's often extremely difficult and painful. And this is certainly one of the reasons why most of the time colonies do fail.
There's little intention, however, to create a new society. It's almost that the people who went there were looking to go back rather than go forwards.
Well, I suppose in history we're often trying to think what's in the mind of the revolutionary, and we can kind of misunderstand them. So these are people who a lot of the time are coming from a society in England which itself is changing rapidly and radically between the end of the 16th century and the middle of the 17th century. So they're themselves in a kind of turmoil. And so that whenever a society is changing quickly, there's always nostalgia. And so that a lot of the religious impulses are nostalgic. Let's get back to the you know, the days of the original early founding fathers of the church. And there's a social nostalgia. Let's get back to charity when neighbours are kind to each other. The golden age of good Queen Bess. And let's get back perhaps to feudalism. You know, if you're a lord of the manor, maybe you don't like the fact the way things are going, feudalism's been abolished. Well, go and recreate your own feudal society. And that's certainly something that Lord Baltimore does in Maryland.
However, this new society is that we're indeed based on visions of an old society. There's still more letters written from the New World and sent to the Old World than vice versa. Why did they need to be so connected?
Oh, there's very many letters that sign off saying, I haven't had any letters from you. When are you going to write? Are you all dead? You know, you sit that side at the Atlantic. These people are expats. They aren't living in an America that we can easily conceptualise working backwards from the modern USA. They're often living in conditions of extreme loneliness. And because they consider themselves to be English and very much part of England, they're incredibly homesick. So that actually writing these letters back, hopefully, is the way that they comfort themselves, that they can bear it. In a way, they're prisoners. You know, in the same way that prisoners or soldiers depend very much on the mail, that's their mentality. So they're very, very anxious about letters. And often they'll write the same letter twice and put it on different ships because they're so keen that the letter will get through and they don't want to give their families any excuse for not replying. So that sense of connectedness is about their essential identity. They're not kind of keeping their hand in with Englishness. It's just who they are.
This desire to remain connected, this desire to remain English, paradoxically actually made them less so as the century developed. How did that happen?
It's a story which is absolutely littered with ironies, and probably the biggest irony of all is that the act of being English abroad is rather exhausting, and that if you're in England, you don't have to try nearly so hard to be English because you just are. But over there, it requires not just a striving in oneself, in one's dress and manners and food, although those things are very important. But when it comes down to things like laws and political rights and liberties, you have to keep voicing them. You have to make what might be implicit in England constantly explicit. And that itself is rather peculiar. So that the voicing of English liberties at one level seems rather English, but at another level it's rather alien. So that striving, that sense of asserting oneself as English is itself rather peculiar. And just generally, this is a new world where there is nothing initially. And so to recreate England requires constant, restless innovation and energy. And that itself, which I do think is part of, you know, what we'd think of as a modern American character, is there not because they're trying not to be English, but precisely because they're trying so hard to carry on being English.
Something else that is, in fact, very alien to them, that they meet straight away, is, of course, the Native Americans who are already there. Yeah. What was their attitude to the Native Americans as they encountered them?
Well, it does vary from place to place. The attitude is generally quite pragmatic on the ground, particularly because they depend upon the Indians for trade. They particularly depend upon them for food. So they treat them a lot of the time with a wariness, for sure, but they treat them as fellow human beings who have to be treated with respect. Otherwise, you know, it's certainly not in the colonists' interests. Of course, at another level, there's a whole ideology about who the Indians are. Nobody can quite decide who they were after Noah's flood, for example. They must be sons of Noah, because everybody is, or they must be the descendants of sons of Noah. But trying to fit them into some kind of scheme of creation is extremely difficult. I think that the standard theological view is that in some way they are cursed, backward, you know, line of Noah's family, and therefore that it is the responsibility of the colonists to save them.
For all the talk of settlers saving Native American souls from heaven's wrath or bringing them happily, as they said, to civility and Christian liberty, there was always this inevitable tension, wasn't there, between these aims and the desire for more land? Was the violence which followed just an inevitable result of capitalist expansion riding roughshod over their better instincts?
I think it is. Again, England is a capitalist country. It's been rapidly capitalising, monetizing, industrialising from the end of the 16th century. You know, there's an early industrial revolution happens in England long before the classic period. And that mentality and that desire is not just exported to America. The part of that trading and manufacturing project is encloses America. So, for example, you might be making buttons in Birmingham or knives in Sheffield. They all get exported over to America, and that they are then traded with the Indians for beaver fur, which is then sent back to England, sent to hatters in London who make felt hats out of the beaver fur. So that these are two economies which are actually, you know, they're not just in parallel, they're deeply connected to one another in a constant dynamic motion.
It's difficult enough to trace the seeds of an idea through 200 years, but I wonder if you can see elements of what's happening now in with government funding for space exploration being withdrawn and private companies stepping into the breach. I wonder if there's a model for the future of humanity's expansion into the solar system.
I think one of the things that really ties those two things together is hope. And often hope, you know, contrary to the evidence, there's something in a certain kind of entrepreneur that always feels, I know that everyone else has failed, but I'm not going to fail. And when I don't fail, when I succeed, I'm going to be incredibly rich. And the fact is, of course, that there are many of those stories. And this is, of course, true in the modern world, too. You hear those stories and you think, I could do that, too. But of course, what you always need to remember in any age is the context of failure. And the context of failure in modern business and the context of failure in early colonization is absolutely enormous. But of course, you don't hear about the failures in the way that you hear about the successes. And particularly in early America, that's usually because they're dead.
Between Two Worlds is published by OUP, while Canongate publishes the Book of Strange New Things in the UK. Thanks to Michelle Faber and Malcolm Gaskill. Next week, we'll be on the trail of James Ellroy as the writer comes to the Guardian Book Club to revisit the first of his LA quartet, The Black Dahlia. Subscribe on iTunes, follow us on SoundCloud, or join us on the Guardian Books website. Just search for Guardian Books Podcast. From me, Richard Lee, and our producer, Eva Krizyak, see you next time.